Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Troopers now had enough to believe that Alexis was an imminent threat of serious injury or death, and they then activated the Alaska Amber Alert System.
Alaska State Troopers have arrested a man connected to an Amber Alert sent last night. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 18th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, firefighters tackle a couple late-season wildfires in the interior.
They've been experiencing strong, gusty winds down there the past few days, and it just brought life to this fire.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud, drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Alaska State Troopers say they've arrested a Fairbanks man connected to an Amber Alert sent last night for a missing teenage girl. Troopers say they were already searching for 51-year-old Stephen Naren for a felony probation violation on Wednesday. Then investigators linked him to the disappearance of 15-year-old Alexis Bain, who'd last been seen in Fairbanks on Sunday. Troopers spokesman Austin McDaniel said troopers determined Naren was with Bain in Anchorage and found his vehicle abandoned in a local park last night.
Troopers now had enough to believe that Alexis was an imminent threat of serious injury or death, and they then activated the Alaska Amber Alert System at approximately 5:24 p.m.
Early this morning, troopers say somebody called 911 reporting a dangerous driver in Soldotna. McDaniel says troopers pursued the vehicle, a white Ford SUV, after the driver refused to stop.
After approximately 3.5 miles, troopers eventually stopped the vehicle using spike strips in the Kasilof area of the Sterling Highway.
McDaniel says the driver turned out to be Naren, who troopers recognized from the Amber Alert. Bain was also in the SUV, and she's now safe, troopers say. Naren was arrested for his active felony probation violation warrant, eluding officers, first-degree misconduct involving a controlled substance, and driving under the influence. While troopers initially said that Naren was believed to be armed and dangerous, McDaniel says he's unsure if Naren had a weapon with him when he was arrested. Troopers are still investigating the incident surrounding Bain's disappearance, and officials say more charges are likely to come. The Amber Alert sent out Wednesday night was the first in Alaska since November 2017. All charges have been dropped against Adam Andrew, the person originally charged in the fire that killed 3 at a housing apartment complex in Bethel. Andrew had been charged with 3 counts of murder in the second degree and 1 count of arson, and an additional 7 felonies and 6 misdemeanors. According to court documents, Bethel Police Department investigator Skylar Smith had relied on the testimony of just 1 15-year-old eyewitness who said he saw Andrew start the fire. The fire started last Friday at around 4 a.m. The prosecutor for the case, Chris Knowles, would not say whether the fire was still being investigated as arson or whether they were looking at other causes. However, he did say there is still an active investigation and that Bethel police are still investigating all leads. Alaska's primary on Tuesday has not narrowed the field of candidates for state offices so much as given a glimpse of the support they have heading toward the November general election. In fact, with the top 4 advancing in each race, only 1 candidate in the legislative primaries was cut after finishing 5th because it was the only race with more than 4 candidates. As Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks points out, the votes tallied Tuesday mostly amount to a state-sponsored poll with a nice big sample size. There are some caveats. After all, candidates can adjust in the next couple months, and dare we say the political landscape can still change. But Brooks says the primary election is a good indicator of what's to come, especially in the governor's race, which shows incumbent Mike Dunleavy solidly in the lead with about 42% of the vote.
Closest to him are independent and former governor Bill Walker and the Democratic candidate, a former Anchorage legislator, Les Guerra. Both of them have around 22%. And since we have a top four primary, the person that's looking like to fill the fourth spot is Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Charlie Pierce, who's running about 6.8%. So trailing all three, but not out of the running and headed on to November himself.
Well, some of us will remember that before Dunleavy was elected, and there was the situation where Byron Mallott won the Democratic nomination, Bill Walker was running as an independent. There were some court battles to kind of figure this out, but eventually Walker and Mallott were allowed to run together, and then they won. So I guess I wonder, is there any kind of discussion of a similar situation happening here with Walker and Guerra, or are people talking about one or the other dropping out maybe to give the other one a better chance?
I haven't heard of any talk like that yet. And I think with ranked choice voting, there's less incentive for that to happen. Because let's say Dunleavy's not at 50%, even after the Pierce campaign is eliminated. Again, in this hypothetical where Pierce is in fourth in November. So let's say even with Pierce's votes, Dunleavy's not at 50%. Well, you go to the next round of knockouts. So if Guerra finishes below Walker, most of Guerra's voters are probably going to go for Walker, and there's a chance that's enough to put Walker over the top. And again, we won't know that because Guerra and Walker are very close together at this point, enough that the results between now and November are almost certainly going to change one way or another.
Yeah, no doubt. And tell me more about that. I mean, of some of the political observers that you've talked to, I guess, what significance do they see in the primary numbers, you know, in terms of how accurate those may even be as a poll?
Right. The more people who participate in the August primary, the better an analogy it'll be for November. Right now, turnout's running a bit above 26% of registered voters. Now, you look at 26%, and that doesn't seem like very much, but it's the highest turnout we've seen in a primary since 2014. And that's when you start to think that, well, maybe August is a good map for what might happen in November. And the question then becomes, what will these candidates and campaigns do to change their positions between now and then?
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see how people react to those numbers, how the candidates react to those numbers. And I guess, I mean, at the same time, you know, a pollster would be pretty happy with the sample size.
Right. And I think the pollsters should be pretty happy with themselves anyway. The results of the primary were pretty darn close to what the public and private polling was indicating going into August. The general order is spot on. And the same with the other statewide races as well.
Yeah, that's what I want to talk to you about next. And I think maybe normally we would save this question for later, but I thought it was interesting that your story about this in the Alaska Beacon, you started off with the one person that was actually eliminated in the Pick One primary, where only the top four are going to advance, but there's this one guy that got eliminated, right?
Yeah. There's almost 200 candidates running for legislative offices this year, 59 races in total, 19 for the Senate, 40 for the state house. And in all of those 59 races, all but one had four or fewer candidates. And since it's a top four primary, nobody gets eliminated. The only place that had five candidates was House District 35, which is up in Fairbanks, Western Fairbanks, covering the university and some areas around it. And in that place, Alaska Constitution Party candidate Kieran Brown is on pace to be eliminated. And then we'll go from there into November across the state.
Of those legislative races that you're looking at, were there, or I should say, are there still some close races?
Yes. One of the things that I've been looking for the most in the legislative races this year is the possibility of a coalition majority next year in the state Senate. Will there be enough Democrats, independents, and moderate Republicans elected that they could take control of the Senate, have a majority of the 20 seats in the Senate, in the same way that the House has been controlled by a coalition majority for the past few years. And so what I'm seeing is moderate Republicans are doing well against more conservative Republicans across the state. I've seen a lot of Democrats doing well, and some very close races that will end up potentially being decisive in November. For example, in West Anchorage, you've got an incumbent House Representative, Matt Clayman, who's challenging a longtime incumbent Republican State Senator, Mia Costello, in a district that was redistricted from a Republican-leaning one into a Democratic-leaning one. Now, on election night, the results are leaning Clayman slightly. Will that change by November? I don't know, but it looks close either way. And then up in Fairbanks, you've got an incumbent Democratic Senator, Scott Kawasaki, who's being challenged by the Republican mayor of Fairbanks, Jim Matherly. That race also looks like it'll be close in November, largely because it was close here this week.
That was Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks, who you can find at alaskabeacon.com. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the first day of school on a military base in Anchorage.
I told the parents last night, you're not guests here, you're part of our family.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Late-season wildfire activity in the Delta Junction and Tok areas drew firefighter responses last night. Alaska Division of Forestry Fire Information Officer Sam Harrell says the first blaze was sparked by a mobile home fire in Delta Junction that was driven into surrounding trees by wind.
They've been experiencing strong, gusty winds down there the past few days, and it just brought life to this fire.
Harrell says firefighters corralled the blaze at 35 acres.
They were able to get around that fire with hose lays and dozers.
According to the Delta Wind newspaper, the camper trailer where the fire started was destroyed along with what it describes as several older structures. The fire is listed as human-caused. There were thunderstorms in the region last night, though, and Harrell says a state forestry helicopter crew that was responding to the Delta blaze spotted two other new wildfires west of Tok.
Those turned out to be two lightning-caused fires that Tok area firefighters and Tok Volunteer Fire Department responded to and was able to get around those two lightning starts.
Harrell says firefighters continued mop-up work on all three blazes today. It's late in the season for new wildfires, and the interior has had periodic rain over the last month, but Harrell says not all areas have received enough precipitation to quell fire potential.
Some of these places have missed the rain that's been moving through, and the duff layer is still dry, allowing these fires to get a hold and go.
Harrell says gusty winds are aiding in both the drying of fuels and wildfire spread. The new blazes come as Alaska wildfire fighting agencies ramp down operations and crews and equipment are sent outside. Harrell says Alaska no longer has any water or retardant dropping planes in state, but has retained helicopters with water bucket capability. He says Alaska also has smoke jumpers and crews available to respond. Kuskokwim River fishermen are urging state fishery managers to open the upper river to silver salmon fishing. Yesterday, for the first time ever, the state closed the entire Kuskokwim and most of its tributaries to nearly all subsistence fishing to conserve the species. State data indicates the run is on track to be the lowest ever and is unlikely to meet state escapement goals for silvers reaching their spawning grounds. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports Upper River residents say that their harvest would not have a large impact on the small run.
While Lower River residents have been allowed to harvest silvers for weeks, the fish have just started arriving in the headwaters, and many residents there haven't been able to harvest any silvers.
It's the human right to have food, man.
Denny Thomas lives in Crooked Creek on the Upper Kuskokwim. He spoke to state fishery managers during Wednesday's salmon management teleconference. The river had just closed to silver fishing that morning.
A lot of what our protein and the protein people eat in this village nowadays is silvers. You don't get enough of the others. And we need to be able to get at least some that we can fillet and freeze.
The state announced the river-wide closure 2 days before it took effect. Thomas and other residents said that didn't give residents time to prepare. The closure restricts more than just silver salmon fishing. It bans gill nets in the Kuskokwim and most tributaries, severely limiting fishermen's ability to harvest other species like whitefish. The month-long closure ends on September 15th. But McGrath resident Kevin Whitworth says by then, the silvers in the headwaters won't be edible.
I call them jello fish, and they're good for dog food, and that's it.
Whitworth criticized state managers for not restricting the coho fishery earlier in a more equitable way. He says a total closure at this point in the season places a disproportionate burden on Upper River residents. In the Lower and Middle River, many residents drifted for silvers over the weekend. They knew a closure could be coming. Callers reported various fishermen harvesting around 30 silvers in communities along the lower waters. Far upriver in Nikolai, where silvers haven't been harvested yet, resident Dan Esai found that news hard to hear.
It's a pretty rough year for us headwaters folks. Not one single family has met their needs. And here we hear about people drifting before the closure. You could imagine what my people feel.
He asked to be able to soak a gill net to harvest whitefish. The Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group passed recommendations to loosen the fishing restrictions. This is a group of river residents that advises state fishery managers. It recommended the river open full-time on the upper waters above Aniak and open to 4-inch mesh gill nets 3 days per week in the lower waters. But state fishery manager Nick Smith said the state would not be able to limit the mesh size in the river. Group members acknowledged that the recommendations prioritize harvest over escapement. However, members also said that the low population along the upper river meant that any silver harvest would not have a significant impact on the run. State fishery manager Smith countered that any harvest adds up and every silver needs to get to the spawning grounds. Last year was the lowest silver run on record, and this year is on track to fall far lower. Data from the state-run Bethel Test Fishery shows the run falling over 60% below the past 13-year average. Next week, the state will stop collecting data on the number of silvers entering the Kuskokwim. The seasonal funding for both the Bethel Test Fishery and the Lower River Sonar will end. State officials are applying to extend those projects next year. Because of the low run, federal managers are not taking control of the Lower River fishery, which would allow subsistence openings for local residents. For KYUK, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Thousands of students across the Anchorage School District went back to school this morning. At Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, the closure of Ursa Major Elementary School added another layer of newness to the first day. Alaska Public Media's Katie Anastas was there this morning and has this report.
Class up!
Yes! Yes!
Now your bodies are frozen, your posture's hot. Ooh, I see some slouching though. Mm-mm, we set up nice and tall.
Catherine Earhart takes her third and fourth grade students on a tour of Aurora Elementary School. It's the first day of school, and Earhart is still getting to know her way around the building, too. She's among the teachers and students sent to new schools on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson this year, after their school, Ursa Major Elementary, was closed over earthquake safety concerns.
It's been overwhelming, and it's definitely been a roller coaster, but we have a really great supportive team here. I think at all schools that are receiving staff and students, they've been really great.
About 200 Ursa Major students started school at Aurora, with others going to Orion Elementary or Ursa Minor Elementary. It might take some getting used to, but Earhart says these students are resilient.
They are very quick to welcome new people. They're very adaptive. So definitely the families and the community that they built is very near and dear to my heart.
Margaret Jones is the principal of Aurora Elementary. She says that community is especially important this year for Ursa Major families. To help with the transition, Aurora held its open house the day before school started, rather than the usual first week of September.
I told parents last night, you're not guests here. You're part of our family.
The start of the school year hasn't been easy. Schools on J-Bear haven't been immune to the district's shortage of bus drivers and cafeteria workers.
Ursa Major was a walk-to school, so about 95% of the students were within walking distance of Major, and so that has been a huge change for them, having to walk to buses.
At Aurora, there are also more classes per grade level this year. Teachers rearranged classrooms to help keep grade levels close together. But Jones says J-Bear students are used to a lot of change.
In a typical Title I school, we see about 23% to 26% mobility rate. On the base schools, we do see a much higher rate, almost double what we see in a Title I school. So, we may not be Title I designated, but we do have a lot of those similar needs.
Those needs include extra social and emotional support. Teachers in each class appoint students to help welcome their new classmates. Earhart says 3 years into the pandemic, there are still signs of its effects on students.
You definitely still see the gap. There's a lot of educational gaps between the students, and you still have a really large range of abilities.
She and Jones say the pandemic has taught students and staff to be flexible. Standing outside Earhart's classroom, Superintendent Jarrett Bryant says he appreciates it.
We have immense gratitude for the families and the staff and the school leaders who have stepped up to make sure it's a smooth transition. It wasn't easy, but being at the schools this morning has showed me that we're all ready to do whatever it takes to make sure that our major students are taken care of.
Earhart says despite the challenges of the last few weeks, she, her students, and their families are ready for a great school year. In Anchorage, I'm Katie Anastas.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
The last of four men charged with killing 16-year-old Palmer resident David Grunwald when they were teenagers has been sentenced. Bradley Renfro, now age 21, was sentenced yesterday to 105 years in prison with 30 years suspended. His convictions include murder, kidnapping, and arson. Prosecutors say Renfro was one of four teenagers who lured Grunwald to a camper in 2016 and beat him with a heavy pistol. The four later drove Grunwald's vehicle for a half hour before walking into woods near the Knick River, where Grunwald was shot and killed, according to prosecutors. Prosecutors also say Renfro had offered places to murder Grunwald, and he had brought gasoline to use to set fire to Grunwald's vehicle, which was found burned miles away near the Talkeetna Mountains. Department of Law officials say Renfro will be eligible for parole after 35 years. The other three men sentenced in the murder of Grunwald are Eric Almendinger and Dominic Johnson, who were each sentenced to serve 99 years in prison. Austin Barrett pleaded guilty and received a 45-year sentence. A first-ever electric vehicle tour event from Fairbanks to Prudhoe Bay and back wrapped up on Tuesday. All 10 EVs that began the non-competitive event last Friday in Fairbanks made it to the end of the Dalton Highway and back, an accomplishment Arctic Road Rally organizers say demonstrates that the technology can work even on a remote stretch of road. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Arctic Road Rally organizer and participant Dimitri Shane says the only problem his Tesla EV encountered along the nearly 1,100-mile trip up the Dalton and back could have happened on any Alaska road.
I got two chips and a flat, yep.
Shane says the windshield damage and deflated tire were pretty much the only issues that the EVs had to deal with during the round trip to Electuck Point, the northernmost road accessible spot in North America.
You know, there's no questions of the fact that can EV truck drive 600 miles? Of course it can. But what it needs is charging.
Shane says the four temporary EV charging stations and infrastructure that rally organizers set up along the Dalton were the most important technology showcased by the event.
That's what the significance was, to be able to bring fast charging to this route and electrify it and make it function like a modern highway does, like in California or in Seattle.
Shane is executive director of the Alaska Electric Vehicle Association, which, along with partner nonprofits Recharge Alaska and Launch Alaska, promote installation of EV fast charging stations on the state's road system. He says many more are needed to enable EV owners to drive long distances in Alaska, a challenge that made it difficult for some road rally participants just to make it to the starting line in Fairbanks.
We had drivers who drove from Homer to Fairbanks. Their charging was more challenging between Homer to Fairbanks than it was from Fairbanks to Electuck Point.
That's because there are no fast charging stations between Soldotna and Cantwell, a distance of about 350 miles, about twice as far as the four charging stations on the Dalton were spaced apart. But rally organizers came up with solutions that could help the state fill those gaps, according to Tim Leach, a transportation expert with Launch Alaska, an Anchorage-based startup business accelerator.
Some of this technology demonstration that we're undertaking here with the Arctic Road Rally will help us identify what technology solutions are suitable, both on the vehicle and the charging side, for some of these communities that have a different set of infrastructure.
The Alaska Energy Authority has been leading the effort to set up fast chargers with help from the Federal Department of Energy and corporate sponsors, and to Alaska Electric Utilities, Anchorage-based Chugach Electric, which helped transport the rally's chargers, and Fairbanks-based Golden Valley Electric Association, which Shane says has been very supportive overall.
Golden Valley is the only utility company in the entire state of Alaska who has invested in building out fast chargers.
Two of those chargers are at Golden Valley's headquarters, and the co-op made them available for rally participants, along with the parking lot for use as the starting line for the event.
We've always had an interest in electric vehicles, and we have had a lot of requests from members to help to support electric vehicles in the interior.
Golden Valley spokesperson Meadow Bailey says that interest in EVs began 51 years ago when the co-op tested an early prototype. She says that project was abandoned when testing showed its primitive battery couldn't keep a charge during cold winter days. That's a problem that maybe could have been alleviated with more EV fast charging stations. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early in Anchorage, Olivia Eberts and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Tim Ellis in Delta Junction. Our audio engineer tonight is Eric Bork. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.